Thanks for tuning in to Inside Scoop Live. I'm your host, Juanita Watson, and joining me today for his second visit to the show is author Dennis Powers. Dennis was a business law attorney before teaching as a full professor and later professor emeritus at Southern Oregon University in Ashland, Oregon. He is a graduate of the University of Colorado, the University of Denver Law School, and Harvard Business School. Dennis is the author of 10 books, including his last 5 about the sea, which has now become his lifelong interest. And just a quick recap of his latest books. In 2005, he published The Raging Sea, which chronicles the crushing 1964 tsunami that ravaged the U.S. West Coast. In 2006, Treasure Ship, and it is about the final discovery of a long-lost steamship that sank off the Northern California coast with millions of dollars in gold. In 2007, Sentinel of the Seas, which tells about the most remote, dangerous, and expensive lighthouse built in this country. And in 2009, Taking the Sea, the adventurous tales of the wreckers or ship salvagers that sailed the oceans. And now his most recent book and the subject of our interview today, Tales of the Seven Seas, The Escapades of Captain Dynamite Johnny O'Brien, the stories of a charismatic, adventurous sea captain of old. Dennis resides in Ashland, Oregon, and for more information about him and his books, you can go to his website, DennisPowersBooks.com. So welcome back to the program, Dennis.
It's great to be here, to be with you, and Juanita, I've got to tell you that I've always really very much enjoyed the work with you and Tyler and Irene at Reader's View, so it's good to be with you.
Oh, it's great to have you back. You know, you had introduced readers to Captain Dynamite Johnny O'Brien in your previous book, Taking the Sea, and I know we briefly touched on him in our last interview, so tell us a little bit about why you felt compelled to write an entire book on this man.
That's a great question, because when I was writing that last book, Taking the Seas, which is about the old ship salvagers and wreckers of the 19th and 20th century, I was really taken by the tales that came out about a seaman who single-handedly saved a 3,000-ton steamship, which was Captain Dynamite Johnny O'Brien. And it was such an amazing story about where this ship that was as long as a football field had struck a reef near British Columbia. The vessel was crushed from stem to collision bulkhead, and the captain and crew quickly, Juanita, abandoned the ship. But although the captain ordered O'Brien to leave and join the rest, he stayed by it, but he was alone on a bobbing raft. When two seamen were sent over to take him, Johnny grabbed him instead, but what happened was that he believed the vessel was seaworthy. It was. When the vessel finally drifted off the imprisoning rocks, he and the two sailors managed to get the sails up. The steam power was totally lost. Was able to sail it, including getting a couple of tows out to Esquimalt in British Columbia, and was able to save the vessel, although it had sunk due to an engineer's mistake. But it was so close to shore, the vessel was allowed to be raised by Captain T.P.H. Whitlaw, who was the subject of that last book. And O'Brien was lauded from coast to coast for the feat, and that really got me into it. It was just an incredible situation. I think the other thing, too, very quickly, is that what really cinched the deal for me was when I came across Pierre Burton's masterful book, The Klondike Fever, and I'll just very quickly read just a few sentences there. What Pierre said about him was, O'Brien, perhaps the most colorful sea captain on the Pacific coast, had a history so garish that it tended to read like one of the more florid sea novels popular at the time. He had narrowly missed being eaten by cannibals, had fought off Chinese pirates with cannon fire, had supped with the royal family of Hawaii, had made love to a Tahitian princess, had been offered a partnership by King O'Keefe, the famous white emperor of the island of Yap, and had shipped with the hairy and villainous Robert O'Malley, prototype for Jack London Seawolf. And when I came across that, Juanita, I said, that deal is done.
What an interesting personality, interesting man. Do you know much about his early life?
Yes, and we were really fortunate on that. The reason for it was that I was so outtaken by the stories that first of all, I went ahead and I was talking and interviewing sea historians. I went into old maritime journals, historical society records, and plowing through worn newspaper clippings to get his background and the stories. And then I had the suspicion that he had memoirs. There were some references that seemed to be that they were in existence, but no one knew really where they were. But after a year-long track, I was able to find them in an Alaskan library, a remote library, and 500 pages of handwritten journals, journal entries, letters. And we were able to put this all together, and it really was a fascinating account. I think the other thing, too, that I'm doing is that I was able to use this so that the book, although it's about this incredible, charismatic sea captain, it really is about what sailing over the oceans was really like then in the 19th and 20th centuries when danger and adventure coexisted on a daily basis. And so it goes from the late 1860s, starting off with O'Brien in India, all the way into the 1930s on the U.S. West Coast, when we had this complete transition of full sail to steamships, and when you had adventure, romance, but also counterweighted with sometimes cruelty, danger, risk, typhoons, hurricanes, sharks, and everything else.
You know, that's a span of about 70 years. The business must have really changed. As well as the sailing vessels during that time. Do you think Johnny or Captain O'Brien changed throughout that time as well?
You know, that's a good question. And when I got into really understanding the person, he really didn't. His love was of the sea. He loved adventure. He had a really very interesting in a way. Complex personality, and as a matter of fact, as I recall, one newspaper when he passed away in 1931 basically said that the personality had so many sides, colorful and vigorous, chivalrous, buoyant, and such depths that it almost baffled analysis, but it had a touch of the magnificent, and in the moment of action, in crisis, it was overwhelming. So he basically stayed the same, although the whole area changed. I mean, this is a time when ships were the trucks, the airplanes, if you will, the roads, the transportation networks throughout not only our country, from the Great Lakes to both the oceans, but also the world. And during this, it was a time of great transition, and O'Brien was changing in terms of what he captained along with that. He even, as a matter of fact, Juanita, took a lower rank from capturing full sail ships, took a lower rank to mate, if you will, and first mate, which would be like the chief operating officer but subject to the captain's will, on steamships so he could learn steamships, learn how they operated and how to command them and what was the best way of navigating them. So he was able to make a seamless transition from full sail to steamships and actually being on the West Coast in Seattle at the time when the Klondike Gold Rush came.
Mm-hmm.
And that's another story.
Mm-hmm. So it sounds like he just wanted to know it all.
He did.
Yeah.
He did. And what was really intriguing about this is that he absolutely loved the sea, and it's like he thrived on the danger.
Yeah, it sounds like he was part adrenaline junkie, part explorer, part romantic. Like you say, so many aspects to his personality.
It was, and the other thing that really intrigued me about it was that, and yet he had this very gentleman side. Whether it was the poorest prospector, or some of the real rich and famous that he met on these journeys on the ships that he captained, along with the fact that he was a very committed family man, and his love of his life being his wife Emily, who in fact sailed with him. to the South Seas and had a variety of experiences with O'Brien. And Emily, in her own right, was a very attractive, charismatic, adventurous person, and was able to give additional dimensions to the story by her strong presence.
So there is a lot of information about her prior to meeting Captain O'Brien?
There was, in terms of through his memoirs.
Okay.
And also through the research that we were able to do. Emily, which was intriguing to me, came from a very established family in Portland, Oregon. Her father, as a matter of fact, was the treasurer of the city of Portland, and she was very much in demand in terms of suitors who were trying to catch her hand. And you know, Juanita, she didn't have a real interest in bounding sea captains, and it was really intriguing that due to his persistence and probably some of his exploits, that he was able to win her over, and she started heading out to sea with him.
So it wasn't necessarily love at first sight, you're saying?
Boy, I'll tell you, that's a good one. It really wasn't. He was smitten with her, and she was had more than one alternative.
Well, there's a big romance that he had with the Tahitian princess that you did allude to earlier, but then he did eventually marry Emily. So what was his experience as this, you know, roaming the seas, being all over the place? What was his romantic life like before he met Emily?
Well, you know, that was what was really intriguing, because he was adventurous with his romances as everything else. He, as a young man, his love affair with a Hawaiian princess, even before sailing to Tahiti, was one that had risk, because their romance had to be kept secret, since the king would not look very kindly at any foreigners who became involved with a princess. And so he romanced her by quietly, stealthily bringing fine horses close to her quarters, avoiding the guards, and then galloping away in the late night to a remote, beautiful beach setting. His love affair with the Tahitian princess, and this is before he had met Emily, was as striking, because despite its intensity, O'Brien sailed away to another island, never to return. And really through that, it's then where he knew that he had had a very quick passing by acquaintance meeting, if you will, with Emily, and he knew that was the lady that he really wanted to win over. Married her, but much later, when he was in his 70s, a company, Juanita, hired him to captain a steamship through the South Seas, and O'Brien returned there. And what happened was a retinue of princesses walked up the boardwalk, placed flowered leis around his neck, and the last one quietly said that she was the granddaughter of his long-lost love, who had since died.
Oh, wow.
And the granddaughter told him the stories that her grandmother held of this beautiful man she had once loved. And we go through a reminiscing through that time.
Oh, that's so touching.
It was really a very touching story when I came through it.
Mm-hmm. And so was that through the memoirs?
Yes, mm-hmm. Yeah. And what really was fascinating to me was how the memoirs lined up with actual events.
Why do you think he wrote his memoirs?
I think there were two reasons. One was the fact that he really was a known personality. He was very well known and regarded in the Pacific Northwest and nationally at the time, which would have been, oh, let's say about 70, 80 years ago. And there's a number of folks that he met that were known. For example, Buster Keaton had heard of his exploits and actually hired O'Brien in as a consultant on his movie The Navigator, which was probably the best one in his mind, and also at the box office that came through. O'Brien regaled them with the stories in terms of The Navigator, which was a real sea story. There was Rex Haney, who was M.J. Haney, who was the builder of the Copper River Railroad, the White Pass Railroad, which were incredible railroad passageways made through the mountains of Alaska and British Columbia. There's Rex Beach, who is a novelist and screenwriter. I think another reason was that he was going to have it published. But then when he passed away, and it probably was just months after he had finished the last notation, the manuscripts just seemed to disappear. Probably Emily decided to hold on to them because they were handwritten.
How did they end up in Alaska?
I think what happened was that he was really a folk hero in Alaska, because he was the one that brought excited men to the gold fields and embittered sick ones back. And he had made numerous friendships with people in Alaskan history who were very well known, such as M.J. Haney, for example, who was this railroad builder. And actually opened up Alaska, with the transportation coming up. And because of this, it was then donated to the Alaska system, which made sense when finally I was able to track it down. I would have thought it would be more on the West Coast, but actually he had captained a very strong, sturdy, huge ship, the Victoria, for 10 years, starting with the Klondike Gold Rush, and there are so many stories there. In retrospect, it made sense that he would have that connection with Alaska, that the family would then donate the manuscript there. But without any fanfare, there was no publicity about where these things had gone.
Isn't that amazing that they've been sitting there that long and you just discovered them?
it really was.
Yes.
It really was, and you see, I was so tempted. I even started writing the story because I had come across so many numerous articles about the Captain Dynamite Johnny O'Brien on the West Coast, it turned out there was even a captain in the name of Dynamite Johnny O'Brien on the East Coast who was of a slightly different era. But Captain Dynamite Johnny O'Brien on the West Coast just had such an unbelievable history. And I think the reason why was, Juanita, was that he was able to survive unbelievable experience, hurricanes, typhoons, fights, insubordination, mutinies, ships that crashed or grounded, illnesses. He was knifed, almost died, and yet had this incredible history and a very good recollection that matched with the things that I was finding articles that had been written about him when he was alive.
And we'll be back with more Inside Scoop Live after these important announcements.
Inside Scoop Live is a global internet-based broadcast specializing in interviewing published authors about their current books and areas of expertise. I'm Juanita Watson, the host of the show, and invite you to join me as I bring to the air both well-known and upcoming writers. You will hear my guests talk candidly about their books, their life experience, specific topics, and the business of being an author in today's literary world. Always interesting and current, my intention is to bring our audience high-quality discussions that spotlight a vast diversity of authors in the field today. Our interviews are syndicated and archived for availability 24/7 through direct podcast and MP3 download. And as always, I love to hear from listeners. Have a look at our website, InsideScoopLive.com. Send me an email, comment on previous guests, and let me know who you'd like to hear on the show. I'll do my best to bring you your favorite authors live and direct. Welcome back to Inside Scoop Live. I'm talking today with Dennis Powers. He is the author of Tales of the Seven Seas, The Escapades of Captain Dynamite Johnny O'Brien. And you can find out more about Dennis and his many books at DennisPowersBooks.com. Well, how did he get his nickname Dynamite Johnny?
Boy, I tell you, is that a good question, too. Avasti, my friend. Actually, it had to do with this, the same ship that about a year later, he had single-handedly, with two others that he had actually shanghaied on board, that saved this ship called the Umatilla. It had run into a terrible gale off the Pacific Northwest, and the huge waves and whipping winds were slamming the vessel about. But if this wasn't bad enough, highly explosive cases of dynamite were being shipped in a hold with a large safe nearby, and when either the ship's rolling snapped the safe from its tying ropes, it became a large battering ram against the cases of explosives. So learning this, O'Brien then climbed down into the hold, lassoed the safe, tied it down with crewmen that he called to come down, and saved the ship from the volatile dynamite, and hence his nickname for the rest of his life. He was called Dynamite Johnny.
Not so bad of a nickname.
Not so bad.
That's great. So your book is called Tales of the Seven Seas. What are really considered the seven seas, and did he sail them all?
Well, you know, what amazed me in my research was that O'Brien sailed over so many oceans, seas, and waterways, from the Indian Ocean, Antarctic, and Atlantic when he was young to the entire Pacific, Atlantic, Arctic as a captain. But the seamen of distant years would say that they sailed the seven seas.
Mm-hmm.
But there isn't one real accepted definition of it. As a matter of fact, there's over 50 seas recognized worldwide. But the more commonly one is one that holds that this is the North Atlantic, South Atlantic, North Pacific, South Pacific, Antarctic, Arctic, and Indian Oceans. And he hit all of those. And what amazed me is that throughout all this, the travels of O'Brien were really distant, adventurous, and amazing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. All of them. Well, how stable was the life of a captain or a seaman? I mean, they basically they didn't have, like, regular routes, did they?
Well, they tried to.
Okay.
But it really made a difference in terms of full sail versus the steamships that O'Brien totally bridged, because the full sail ships were at the mercy of typhoons, lack of winds, harsh weather, running out of food and water, and so they would have to port to wherever they could find. And on the other hand, when steamships came in, they could sail 24/7 with all the food and water that they need, allowing them to have regular routes. Mm. But the other thing, though, is that seamen versus captains, seamen also tended to be more capricious in their travels. You know, unhappy sailors would skip out at the next port, somewhere Shanghai or drugged. And we had stories there that I came across from O'Brien in terms of the shanghaiing of sailors out of San Francisco.
What would happen?
The head of these boarding houses, the seamen boarding houses at the ports, would cut a deal with a captain that couldn't quite get enough men.
Mm-hmm.
And would be very happy to oblige, and the poor sailor would wake up on a distant ship with all the money gone and heading off to another port.
Oh, God.
But, you know, even the sea captains had their plans changed because collisions, you know, sank ships, negligence, things like that. But O'Brien had this unbelievable ability to survive to a ripe old age despite all these hurricanes, icebergs, accidents, mm-hmm. groundings and such.
And he eventually did settle into a home base off the West Coast, right?
Yes, he did. And that was due to when Emily and he decided that their two young children should have a stable place to be able to for school and a stable environment. They decided to make the Pacific Northwest and Seattle their home base. And then that was why he was there when the Klondike Gold Rush burst upon the scene.
Oh, so that was he moved in and settled before. Tell us a little bit about the whole Klondike Gold Rush and his part in it. And it sounds kind of like he was just at the right place at the right time.
Yeah, it was. And what was amazing there was that back in August of 1896, Skookum Jim Mason, who's a Tagish Indian, had discovered the Klondike Goldfields. But it was a full year before the news came in. And the way the news came in was by ship into San Francisco and Seattle when prospectors, grubby, bearded, some very sick, dragging burlap bags of gold dust and nuggets. One had 100 pounds in suitcases. And when this happened, the Klondike gold rush was on in a fury. I mean, policemen left their posts. Trolleys came to a halt as the drivers decided to head off to the closest ship to try to get to where the fabled land of riches was. And so O'Brien, right from the beginning, was there taking the first prospectors into the Klondike, which would really mean bringing them into through the interior passage into Skagway and Dyea. And then the would-be prospectors had to make their way over a torturous path, Chilkat Pass, and then go after from Lake Linderman some 600 miles through the Yukon River down to Dawson City. And it was on that initial trip or two that he met a young budding writer by the name of Jack London. O'Brien invited to his stateroom to tell his sea stories about one O'Malley, who was the hard case mate of a foresail ship that O'Brien had commanded in the South Seas. And at that time, the writer, the would-be writer, if you will, Jack London, had made copious notes on these. And although the scholars still debate just what entered into London's character, Wolf Larsen and the Sea Wolf, he met with O'Brien at the right time, and in Tales of the Seven Seas is able to describe this in detail. What was interesting there is I had contact, Juanita, with scholars, Jack London scholars, and I found out that there was this opening where they weren't sure how Jack London had gone basically to get into Dyea, if you will, which is really really further north, in terms of this passageway, and son of a gun, it all just meshed in, including descriptions that O'Brien had where Jack London was trying to catch up with them after Jack London's trip around the world, if you will, where then he ended up in San Francisco and was trying to catch O'Brien, but O'Brien then was off on another voyage.
Adventure somewhere. What an incredible connection you made.
Yeah, it was really amazing because I've been a fan of Jack London's for years with the books that he had written, and it was really, to me, a real plus to be able to talk with other folks who had studied in detail Jack London and what he was doing and what the trip was like on London's part after he left O'Brien and then was trying to make his way through and into the gold fields, where he finally got into the Yukon and had a miserable winter and then was able to make his way back up to St. Michael's in the Arctic to finally make his way home. And then a couple years later, he hit the scene with the Call of the Wild and then with the Sea Wolf.
Mm-hmm. Well, I know you love to travel a lot, Dennis. Have you ever taken a trip up to Alaska and traced any of the steps?
I was able to go into Alaska on two trips, and I was able to see the ruggedness of the country that was there. Also to experience the fact of when storms could come in, they can come in very, very quickly. There was even another gold rush that happened a few years after the Klondike one, which was at Nome, which is at close to the Arctic Circle, and that was in 1900. And in that, I really have to say, Juanita, it is incredible because these are shallow waters that come into this tiny settlement, and when the gales whip in, you have frothing seas and ships are bounded about. And O'Brien yet was the one that never lost the ship when he was bringing these excited men, if we will, to the gold fields, and then he saw what happened when He was bringing the unsuccessful ones back. But he made numerous friendships with not only the prospectors, adventurers, and folks like that, but also those up in Alaska and Canada who built the cities and railroads.
It must have been an incredible time to be a witness to that part of history.
You know, it was. And what's amazing is that to be able to take a look at this window of how it was. And it's almost like the only thing we don't know is a history that we haven't read, because men and women have the same emotions, even though we have all this technology today. They're driven by the same things. There was more risk then. We have more social structures now in place that someone runs into a problem, more financial structures, government programs in place that they didn't have then. It was a time of our great-grandfathers, and in some cases our grandfathers and grandmothers, who were very adventurous folks, and it gives us a window into how their souls were.
That's fascinating. Well, what adventure of Captain O'Brien's really impressed you or touched you the most?
You know, I the ones that hit me, aside from all the stories that were there, and these were stories that could be shared by other sailors. Although, as I mentioned, it's a biography, it really is a way and a vehicle where I could show what life was like on the seas in that time, including from the pastor's point of view. What it was that he would make decisions in a crisis that really had a touch of the magnificent. And I'm just borrowing the words of others on that. For example, he was captaining a 4,000-ton ship into British Columbia, British Columbia waters, and then into Alaska on the building of one of M.J. Haney's railroads.
Mm-hmm.
And ship, a 4,000-tonner, a large one, was laden down with railroad cars and ties, and a gale came in there, and all of a sudden the whole ship was going under. It was submarining. And without thinking twice, he ordered to increase the speed, took the risk to take and to go off into a diagonal and to actually try to go into, to plow through a trough, and through some other ways was able to save the ship and save the crew. And yeah, I'm really touched by that, mm-hmm. because, you know, when we have an emergency, you know, everything's on the line. And yet he had this that happened, much more regularly than we would like in our lives today.
I don't think there are any modern-day comparisons to a personality or a profession such as this.
I think that's a very good observation, except on the high seas, although you don't have them as often as they did then, because we have we need GPS, and we have helicopters and radar, and we have a lot of
satellite.
More modern technology.
Yep.
We do have that, but, you know, we still have ships that disappear, that ground, that flip over because of a mistake made. Even today, we have the risk on there. I mean, for example, Brian had an escapade where he was able to avoid the pirates of Nine Pin Rocks off of Hong Kong, and today we have the ones off of Somalia with their motorized rafts, grenade launchers, and machine guns.
Mm-hmm.
And so
mm-hmm.
you still have the seas are still risky. They, although laws and lawyers try to tame them now, the seas still have risk and venture.
Yeah, good point. Good point. So you've written so many books, Dennis, but you talk so passionately about this one. Has this become your favorite?
You know, that is one I gave some thought to, and each of the past books had something that stands out to me. But I really have to admit, although it's hard to choose from The Raging Sea all the way to Taking the Sea, it's hard to choose. I have to go with Dynamite Johnny O'Brien right now because of the adventures. And the fascinating life, and the life, but this is a life also, Anita, that had an underbelly of hard men, of cruelty, of needing to show courage at an instant of deprivation. So there was an underside here. And I think that balance is what really brings this around for me.
And I think this is your first book where you've actually taken one person and dedicated a whole book.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
Absolutely right. And again, the reason why I was able to do it was that the stories that came from this one person's life were so able to be applied.
Read like fiction.
It read like fiction, although what was amazing, though, is, as Pierre Burton was saying, it was so garish it tended to read like these florid sea novels. But in checking out, various things, like for M.J. Henney, on that one, people were saying, yes, he had this closest friend, Johnny Dynamite O'Brien, who brought about the fact of the railroad being built from Cordova rather than another port that J.P. Morgan was putting some money into. And so it was a way of opening up history and yet to have a consistent theme, and I really liked being able to use that.
Oh, great. Well, so what's coming up next for you? Are you working on any future projects right now?
You know, my friend, I'm still looking at other types of alternatives and sea stories, as you and I were chatting about just before we came on.
Mm-hmm.
I was over in the Middle East crossing the Red Sea and spent time on both sides. And was in Egypt, Saudi Arabia, and Jordan, looking at a particular type of approach there. So I am looking and reviewing. And, you know, I got to tell you that the path is as exciting, if at times not more so, than the final destination.
Such is life.
Such is life.
That's great. Well, let's mention your website again. It's DennisPowersBooks.com. And so what can we find there? And then maybe tell us a little bit about any upcoming events you may have that will be posted on your website.
No, okay. What we'll find there will be a question and answer. There's excerpts. There's also from on the home page right off the bat, there's different of the images that are in the book itself, and then also there's a lineup of the other maritime books that I've written. Next week, as a matter of fact, I head up to Portland to the Oregon Convention Center for in the morning to go ahead to the Public Librarians National Convention. So I'm going to be at a booth there, which will be fun.
Oh, great.
And, lots of other different things that come up. I enjoy the working on the support after a book comes out because I meet such interesting people.
Mm-hmm.
Also gives me a chance to reconnect with folks like yourself and Irene.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, we'd love to reconnect with you, definitely.
I do, too.
Yeah. It sounds like you've had some other publicity with some biggies in it. States this right on your homepage on your website with USA Today and some TV spots.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
Yeah, absolutely. I've been having from CNN hard copy and extra to the O'Reilly Factor on past books, and public radio. Numbers of different ones that are good. And what's interesting there is again, I have a chance to catch up with folks and say, "How you doing? How's your life been?"
Yeah, I think the interest in the sea and in books like you put out will always be there. So we just hope that you continue doing what you're doing, Dennis.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that.
Yeah, absolutely. Sure. Did you have any final thoughts that you wanted to share with our audience today?
Well, I just want to say that I've appreciated the readers and the folks who have kept up with my past books and that this particular one certainly fits in with the rest. It's one that I really enjoyed researching and writing on, and I'm just very appreciative of being able to be in this business.
Yeah, absolutely, and it's getting fantastic reviews, so
yes,
congratulations.
Thank you, and I've been fortunate there again.
Yeah, for sure. Dennis, as always, it has been a pleasure. We will do it again.
I would look forward to it. It is my pleasure. My best to you and Irene and Tyler and all the folks.
Great, Dennis. You take care. Thanks again for coming on.
Have a great one.
You too. All right, listeners, again, that's been Dennis Powers, his new book, Tales of the Seven Seas, The Escapades of Captain Dynamite Johnny O'Brien, is on shelves now, and you can pick that up through online booksellers, your local bookstores, or Dennis's website, DennisPowersBooks.com. So I hope you have enjoyed this very insightful, interesting interview with Dennis today. He's always a great guest to have on the show. So I just want to thank you for tuning in to Inside Scoop Live. I'm Juanita Watson, and until next time.